We're in the final season of the Nine in a Row Chronicles podcast, although it's not the final episode because we are going to have an episode next week, which is really about why the 10 didn't happen. This one's obviously fresher memories, and Anthony, more memories, and even I start to have memories of this one. So it's a bumper one of 2 hours, so I'll try not to keep you. If you're listening to this, the season started off we're at Eurovision Song Contest time just now. So that's what is number one at the end. It's ABBA with Waterloo, but it started off with Donny Osmond and Young Love. Wizard would have been next, and a wee bit disappointed the season didn't kick off a wee bit later. Didn't finish a wee bit later, because I would have had the Rubettes, Sugar Baby Love, and I can remember getting, my brother got the album and it had a Rubettes flat cap paper version. Anyway, if you're watching the television when the season kicked off, again, getting back into the stuff that I can remember, Saturday morning you would have watched Trumpton, then the Pink Panther, then the Aeronauts, then Grandstand, of course, always Grandstand, presented by Frank Boff. And then after Grandstand you would have had the Cartoon Carnival, News, Harry Langdon, now I don't remember that, Dad's Army, and it wouldn't have been a repeat, it would have been the actual episode first time round, the Saturday Western, Billy the Kid, then Luke, Mike Yarwood, and This Is Me. And then World Heavyweight Championship Boxing, the undefeated George Foreman versus Jose Roman of Puerto Rico in Tokyo. Goodness. Then the news, then Match of the Day in England, Sports Union Scotland, then the life and death of the Scharnhorst, written and presented by Ludwig Kennedy. No idea. Something to do with a German warship. Anyway, enough of me. This is a season where we won the league. We had the Atletico Madrid issue. But I'll let the boys talk about everything. This is me, Harry Brady, talking over Donny Osmond. ABBA will be at the end. So we are now down to the final season of the Nine in a Row Chronicles. There's a tear in my eye as I say that. And season 73-74 may have been the final season. It was another double winning season, but it was an amazingly eventful season. For me personally, it was one of the first. It's the first season that I can start to remember things. I looked at what the possible number ones would be, and obviously having a brother 3 years older than me and a brother 6 years older than me, who the oldest one 6 years older than me was always into his music. So that's why I can remember watching Top of the Pops for every single one of the number ones. I have to say before we get going, Christmas 73-74. And nobody's allowed to dispute this, was the greatest Christmas ever. Because my oldest brother got Scalextrics, my next brother got World Cup 74 Subutio set, and I got a big giant Action Man tank. So
I have to say, I might agree with you there, because I got a West Ham football strip. I got a Munich 74 World Cup football. And I get these glove puppets. One was meant to be Henry Cooper, and another one was meant to be Muhammad Ali. And they'd be levers, and they punched each other.
Oh, I remember. Yeah, I remember those things.
So that's us. Review of the season. Thanks very much, everyone. So we will start off with, as we always do, the League Cup. But before we go in the League Cup, we do need to dip our toe in the Dryburgh Cup. July 29th of July 73, Celtic beat Dunfermline 6-1. They beat Dundee 4-0, and we have another losing Dryburgh Cup final to Hibs, 1-0 after extra time. Lucky, Robert, either of you at the Dryburgh Cup?
Was that the final? I remember the final.
So what?
The final, because I was a great admirer of Alan Gordon, and when he scored a very late winner, I think it was after extra time, but. I don't remember the other games.
Yeah, I was at all three of them. And the game against Dunfermline, Bobby Lennox had a great start to this season, and he scored 4 in that game against Dunfermline. And then on the Wednesday night, we beat Dundee when Brian McLaughlin scored a fantastic solo goal. I think he might have got two that night. And yeah, the game against Hibs in the final was totally different from the final against Hibs 12 months earlier when they'd beaten us 5-3 after extra time. This one went extra time as well, and as Lackey said, 119th minute when Alan Gordon, they got a quick counter-attack, very good goal, very good finish by Alan Gordon, past Ali Hunter. And Brian McLaughlin played in all three games and then kept his place for the League Cup section matches, and we were drawn in the same group as Rangers. But it was less significant because there was going to be two teams qualifying from the group in this season, and we had Arbroath and Falkirk as well in our group, and Celtic and Rangers took maximum points off Arbroath and Falkirk. But we did go to Ibrox and beat them.
Jamie Johnson was sent off.
Jamie got sent off the Parkhead game, but the Ibrox game was when your favourite Harry Hood came on and turned the game, Lackey, because it was 0-0, I think, with about 10 minutes to go, but Hood had come on, and actually Rangers had been well on top first half. Ali Hunter had some good saves. Rangers had played the exact same team that beat us in the Scottish Cup final in May, and Harry Hood scored one and set one up for Bobby Lennox, and they got a goal right at the death. A guy, Ali Scott, who was a new striker for them. I think the view was that we'd sneaked it, maybe slightly fortuitously, and then 7 days later at Parkhead, it was the opposite. We demolished them in the first half. Lennox scored. I think we were goal disallowed, came close many times. And then, not for the first time, you know, an Old Firm game completely changes in the second half. And they scored two very quick goals, Alex McDonald and Parlane. And then Jinky got sent off. And that all happened before the 60th minute. And Johnson get sent off for a clash with Alex McDonald, and not the last time that would happen in an Old Firm game either. And we played really well that day, but and still looked like scoring at 2-1 down and a man down, but Alfie Conn broke away, scored, and so they Rangers won the group, actually. But as I say, with two teams going through into the second round, it didn't matter so much, so they you know, they hadn't been able to eliminate us from the League Cup at this stage.
The Drybra Cup final is the first time I ever remember being at a game and Celtic lost. and I was gutted that day because I'd been at maybe about 20 games, and mostly home games. And I think it was the first time I'd ever been to Hampden as well. And I was dead excited. And I remember the anticlimax of it went to extra time and Hibs got a late goal. And we were in the South Stand, and I could see Pat Stanton getting the trophy, and I was just absolutely crestfallen at the thought of Celtic losing, you know, a game. And the other thing that strikes me at that period is the team. We've always talked each week about the evolution of the team. At the start of the 73 season, things really began to change. Ali Hunter became the number one keeper. Brian McLaughlin had a great run in the team. Normally what Jockstein would do is he would give a boy a chance for two or three games and then put him back in the reserves, bring him back in and bring him in gradually. But McLaughlin has just been put in and played all the way through August right into September, and he'd Andy Lynch in the left wing, and there was another one as well. I was going to say
Steve Murray
was the had replaced Bobby Murdoch. Bobby had moved on to Middlesbrough at the beginning of in August. So there's a sea change here in the lineup. This is quite an unusual thing for Jockstein, because he did quite a lot of changes in a close period of time, which is something that he wasn't used to doing.
Well, actually, can you guys, before we get on to talk about the games,
There's a player, Stevie Murray, played 57 games this season. And my first game was this season. So there's a guy who played 57 games. I start going to Celtic games at this point, and I have no memory of ever seeing Stevie Murray play. But people say he would have been a fantastic player for Celtic. So who wants to talk about Stevie Murray?
Well, I thought he was a magnificent player. He was a really good player at Aberdeen. And when they signed him, I thought it was a really strong acquisition. But, obviously injury and into that. But he was a different type of player from Bobby Murdoch. As I said to you last week, he was more of a push and run type player, pass and go, whereas Bobby used to sort of dictate the play and make long, short passes as it suited him. There were different types of players, but I think if Stevie Murray hadn't had that injury, he would have probably been a great Celtic player. In fact, it's funny because there's been a number of Stevie Murrays that have played for Celtic and have all had bad injuries.
The thing about Murray is, He was obviously signed to replace Bobby, and as Lackey said there, there were different types. Now, the tactics within football was changing at this time. Up until probably 72, 73, almost every team would have played a 4-2-4 formation. Celtic, obviously, would have had Murdoch in midfield, either Bertie Auld or maybe Tommy Callaghan or somebody like that. But as the tactics begin to change, more and more teams begin to play 4-3-3. And your three midfield players, generally speaking, are meant to be very mobile. And we were lucky to have players like that. We had Stevie Murray, we had Davey Hay, we had Pat McCluskey if needed, with Tommy Callaghan. So these guys were box-to-box players, whereas Bobby basically played in the middle of the park and dictated the play. And there's something quite sad about that, because a wee bit of the artistry, by all accounts, went out of the game at that stage when the likes of Bobby Murdoch and players like him began to pass on.
I think Murray was... he had such a good season for us that he might well have made the Scotland squad for the 74 World Cup had he not ducked out of a couple of squads earlier in the season because of his commitments at the Open University, where he was doing a degree course. And I think on two occasions he turned down Scotland politely because he felt as if he couldn't commit. And for that to happen in a World Cup year was unusual, I would say, for a professional footballer. But I think I read an article about him recently. Does he live in Los Angeles or something? Is he, he's an artist or?
He's actually staying in Dundee at the moment, but I think he was abroad for a while. His son, I think, was out in the States, and I think he was out to stay with him. But he's back in Dundee now.
When he played for Dundee, he was a very, very good player, and Aberdeen's record signing. But he missed the cup final in 1970 because he'd already been cup tied. But when Martin Buchan left Aberdeen, he became the captain. So, he was a player of some influence at more than one club. And it was just unfortunate that his spell with Celtic was so short, because he really was a very good footballer.
So if we get back onto the League Cup, we beat Arbroath, beat Falkirk, beat Rangers, beat Falkirk, lost to Rangers, beat Arbroath. And so we were through, because two teams went through, we played Motherwell in the second round.
Can you hear me?
Yes. I can hear you, Stephen. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Brian, what about you?
Yes.
The voice has disappeared.
I can hear. Can you not hear me?
Can you hear me?
Yes, can hear you.
I can hear you now. Can you hear me, Robert?
Yes.
Yes, and I can hear.
Okay.
Well,
right, sorry. Okay. So we're in the League Cup. Back to the League Cup, where we beat Arbroath, we beat Falkirk, we beat Rangers, we beat Falkirk, we lose to Rangers, we beat Arbroath, and we're through to the second round. Which is a two-leg affair. We beat Motherwell at Fir Park. Obviously expecting we've won there, so we come back and lose at Celtic Park, and so it's there's no away goals or anything, so we have a replay, so a third game against Motherwell, where we win 3-2. We then quarter-final, we beat Aberdeen 3-2 at Celtic Park, 0-0 up at Pittodrie, and then semi-final, we beat Rangers 3-1 before losing to Dundee 1-0 in the final. So who wants to take us through from who wants to take us through the League Cup? We've talked about the group stage there, so who wants to take us through? Robert, do you want to start on those games?
Sure. Yeah, I was at all three games against Motherwell, and Ian St John was the manager of Motherwell at the time, and they were starting to put together a pretty robust team. And as we'll discover, you know, we played Motherwell 7 times this season because they took us to a replay in the Scottish Cup as well. Yeah, we won quite more comfortably at Fir Park than the scoreline suggests. But then in the Parkhead game, they scored. George Connolly missed a penalty and it went extra time and finished 2-2 on aggregate. As you say, no away goals that would have taken us through. There was then a toss of a coin to decide where the third game would be played. If you remember last season, there had been a third game required against Dundee, which was at Hampden. The choice this time was that the third game would be at either Parkhead or Fir Park, and we won that toss of the coin, and we played Motherwell on a Monday night at Parkhead in an absolutely tremendous game. Motherwell had a little centre-forward, Bobby Graham, who played at Liverpool for a few seasons under Bill Shankly. He was an excellent player, and they'd a few meaty players at the back as well, like Joe Wark and Peter Miller and guys like that. Anyway, it finished 3-2, and Jinky scored in the last minute. It was quite a controversial goal. And 2 days later, on the Wednesday night, we played Aberdeen at Parkhead in the first leg of the quarter-final. And that was a magnificent game, which also finished 3-2 to us. Dalglish had a good night, scored a couple of goals. He was playing against a very young Willie Miller that night in the Aberdeen defence. And Drew Jarvey got two for Aberdeen. And at the end of the day, it was Pat McCluskey that won the match for us. Don't remember anything about the away game, which was a 0-0.
Robert, there's one thing about the away game I want to say there that I thought you may have remembered. It was an afternoon kickoff because of the restrictions on floodlights.
Right.
And I remember it for two reasons. I remember unusually being at school and a Celtic game being on and not knowing the score. And the other thing as well is the older guys that I know, guys your age, very few of them actually got to that game because there was travel restrictions. So there was still a big crowd at Pittodrie, but it would have been very much the majority of local Aberdeen people. But it's just to note, it was an afternoon kickoff.
Well, great that you mentioned that. And in fact, there was a fuel shortage at the time. So the economy, this was the last few months of Ted Heath's government, but the economy was in disarray because the OPEC oil producing countries had imposed an embargo on production and on exports to countries like the UK, who had kind of supported Israel in the Yom Kippur War against the Egyptians and the Syrians. So there was a massive fuel shortage which affected lighting and floodlights, affected heating, it affected businesses, and it's all kind of built up, I suppose, to the 3-day week, which came a wee bit later in the year, around about the time of the final. So, yeah, we got, strangely, having played Rangers twice in the League Cup section, we then got Rangers again in the semi-final. And this is a very famous game for any Celtic fan who was there. And it was the most miserable weather. It was lashing. And Harry Hood and Alex McDonald, they got the goals in the first half. And then second half, we played well. Harry Hood got his hat-trick. Then he got a fourth goal, very controversially disallowed, and that would have made him the only Celtic player in history to score four against Rangers if that had stood. And the great memory in the Celtic end, and it was heavy rain for the whole game, but the whole Celtic end was singing in the rain, the Gene Kelly song at the end of the game, when we knew the game was more or less won. And it was, yeah, it was quite a unique experience. I mean, last week I was mentioning Judy Garland, and this week Gene Kelly. It's a, it's a quite unexpected. So I think the tragedy of the final, when you don't win a final, when you've already knocked Rangers out of the competition, I think it makes the defeat in the final against Dundee even harder to take. And somebody had scheduled the final for 10 days before Christmas, and it had snowed for much of the week. And I think from memory, there was a transport strike, because I definitely walked to Hampden that day, which I would never have done because I always took the train to Mount Florida. And the game was a 1:30 kickoff because of the inability to use floodlights. Although I think 1:30 is maybe cutting it a bit fine in December in Glasgow if the match had gone the extra time. I still think we might have ended up in darkness. But so it was absolutely freezing. I think at the pitch inspection, it's reported that both Jock Stein and Davey White, who was Dundee manager by then, both of them considered the pitch to be unplayable. It was frozen hard underneath, but it was a bit muddy on top because it was raining on the day of the game. But the referee, who was Bobby Davidson, decided that the pitch was playable and the match went ahead. And people were just... The crowd was only 27,000. I think not many people made it through from Dundee because of the transport chaos in the country at that time. Tommy Gemmell was the captain of Dundee, so he hadn't stayed that long down at Nottingham Forest. And it was the most abysmal match. It was... There was no sense of occasion because it was an empty stadium. It was freezing. Players were slipping all over the pitch. And the remarkable thing was that Dundee's goal to win the cup was a fantastic strike by their centre forward, Gordon Wallace. He took a free kick from the halfway line. He took it on his chest inside the box and he swiveled and he hit it in the corner. It was a fantastic goal. And it was big Tommy Gemmell that went up to lift the trophy.
I think
there was a suggestion. There was a suggestion that the reason why the game was not cancelled was because it was attended by Sir Stanley Rouse, the president of FIFA, plus other members of a FIFA delegation who wanted to observe for themselves the offside law that had been adopted in the Scottish League Cup that season with the extension of the 18-yard line. I don't know whether that's true or not, but it was certainly one of the worst cup finals I've ever been to in my life under many different categories.
I think to be fair, Dundee played well. And Tommy Gemmell had a terrific game, marshalling the defence. I don't think he played left back.
I think you're right. I think he was centre-back.
And he organised them brilliantly, so he did. I mean, that day, and I saw him in other games later on in the season, we might talk about, he was magnificent. He really, I mean, Tommy Gemmell was a much better player than folk give him credit for. In terms of...
Yeah, I think as a junior player, he had played centre-half.
Possibly.
A lot. I remember thinking at that League Cup final that he looked as if he'd put on a couple of stone since he left Celtic, which was about 2 years earlier. But as you say, Lachie, he played really well. Celtic didn't have many chances. And I think when we did get through, they had a very good goalkeeper, Thompson Allen, who ended up going to the World Cup. He was the form goalkeeper in Scottish football that season.
In a sense, he was almost like in a parallel the way we've talked about Bobby Murdoch going to Middlesbrough, that there's no real substitute for experience if you have ability. So you may get a wee bit slower and you might get a wee bit heavier, but you know so much, your knowledge base about how the game of football is played allows you to help other players round about you. He always played like a quarterback. The way he showed the defence.
Because Tommy Gamble was on record as saying that he felt very uncomfortable going up to get the trophy. Because round about were the in the main stand, it was all faces that he recognised for his Celtic days. And he says that as much as he was happy, he did feel a sense of feeling uncomfortable, and that he there were so many people that he knew.
Did you manage to get to any of the League Cup games, Lackey?
I can't remember, because I was playing that time. So Saturday games, I wouldn't have gone to. I think I was probably at the Aberdeen game, the 3-2 game, which Robert refers to, which was a good game. But I know that the second game wasn't a riot off the pitch, but it was a very violent game on the pitch. It was described as a brawl by the media at the time, the 0-0 game. So I don't know whether Aberdeen thought they could roughhouse it, but and Celtic fought fire with fire. But it wasn't a good game. Robert Lee rightly describes the first game as a great game of football. The second wasn't.
So we have once again lost in a League Cup final. So we'll get to the league, which is an interesting league campaign, particularly towards the end, but we'll get to the league. We start off on the 1st of September, 3-2 away at Dunfermline. Again, it shows that the modern thing for the champions, start the season at home, wasn't up and running yet because we were away at Dunfermline. We beat Clyde 5-0, and then the first Celtic Rangers game of the season takes place in the 15th, or in the league that is, takes place on the 15th of September, and Celtic win at Ibrox. Lackey, do you have any memories of that game?
I think it was at that game. I think Jimmy Johnson scored with a header.
He did.
That's right. Remember that, because it never surprised me when Jimmy scored with headers, because he was good for a wee guy. I mean, he was never going to jump like Billy McNeil, but he knew how to time it, how to nip in, how to get in front of a defender.
Just very quickly before you carry on, St Anthony there mentioned the teams. The Celtic team for that game was Hunter McGrain, Brogan, Murray, McNeil, Connolly, Johnson, Hood, Dalglish, Hay and Wilson. Rangers team was McCloy, Jardine, Matheson, Greg, Johnson, McDonald, McLean, Forsyth, Parlane, Conn and Young.
I want to mention, before you go into the Rangers one, is 7 days before it, Celtic played Clyde at Celtic Park, and Brian McLaughlin's Celtic career, in all essence, finished that day when he was a victim of a very crude tackle by a guy called Willie McVee.
Yeah.
Now, the McLaughlin at that point, and certainly, but when I was at the age I was at, even I appreciated that this guy was an exceptional player. He was such a skillful player. He was very slight, but he was fast. Jock Steenwood was on record as saying that he was a better prospect at the same age than Kenny Dalglish.
Yes.
And we were so excited as fans at that point because he was going to be the next big thing. And all as a result of that one tackle, Brian's career basically ended at Celtic. He did return and play a few games, but he could never reach the mobility of the knee, from what I can gather. It was never the same. Now, I think these days when you've got keyhole surgery, it may have been different, but in those days, my recollection is that it was described as almost like a butcher's job on his knee, because they did the best they could. But Jockstein was very aware of the fact that the boy was never going to be the same again, and it's something that I look back on in later years would be a great deal of regret, because Brian McLaughlin, had he continued to make the progress, would have been one of the all-time Celtic greats.
I think so. I saw him before he came into the first team. He played for the Scotland under 21s, I think, at Firhill. Franklin Rowe of later fame was also playing for the Scotland under 21s at the time. And there was a guy with me who was from England. He was a teacher that I knew, but he was a very, very good coach. He was held in high regard by a lot of the kids that he worked with, including Tommy Burns, because he worked with him as a schoolboy, and he came away raving about Brian McLaughlin. He said he was just he was going to be a magnificent player, which he really was. And I agree with you, Stephen, it was an assault. Mm-hmm. Now, I knew a guy, a Celtic supporter, who maintained that a more experienced player would never have gone for the ball, and he brought it on himself. And I said he had the ball. He actually had the ball and was going past the guy, and he just took him out of the game. Now, I noticed that in Potter and Campbell's book, they said it was an unfortunate accident. I was at that game, as you probably were, and it was an assault on a young player by a very experienced pro. Now, he maybe didn't mean to finish his career, but he certainly tried to do him that day.
Yeah, I think he was only 18 at the time, so, you know, he wasn't really that much older than Tommy Burns, and, you know, the thought of, you know, these guys playing in the same midfield and is very exciting. And I think in the 10-11 games that McLaughlin played at the start of this season, he'd already started to develop a brilliant understanding with
Dalglish.
With Dalglish, yeah.
The other thing about that game is, Brian, that that was the game whereby the flag was unfurled for 8 in a row, and the Scottish League let is where the number 8, everybody wore the number 8 shorts in tribute to 8 in a row, even the goalkeeper. So sometimes when you see photographs and you see Danny McGrain in number 8 and Billy McNeil in number 8, you think, what was going on there that day? Well, that's the reason for it. Everybody wore number 8. And I often think it peculiar that we were allowed to do it for 8 in a row, but we didn't do it for 9 in a row. So I don't know if maybe the Scottish League felt that somebody complained or something like that, but I find it a bit unusual that we did it for 8, but we never did it for 9.
I think the thing about that was, because of that sort of celebration, and Celtic played very well, won 5-0, it should have been a day of great rejoicing. Mm-hmm. But then you watch this potentially wonderful player being carried off in a stretcher. It really put a cloud over the whole event. Mm-hmm.
There was a suggestion in one of the books I read, and I can't remember which book, but Willie McVee was playing in a reserve match against Celtic sometime within sort of 12 months of this game, and one of the Celtic players was earmarked to do him during the match. At the first available opportunity, doesn't name the player.
Well, I mean,
I'm not sure. You know,
well, it wouldn't surprise
but
me.
It's been written. It's been written.
Mm-hmm. It wouldn't.
Nobody named.
It wouldn't surprise me, because, you know, players have done that, managers have done that, immemorial, to tell, you know, go and get that guy, take him out and teach him a lesson, and players talking amongst themselves. To a lesser extent, when I played at a much lower level, I always remember I had a quite pragmatic coach one time, who gave us a lesson in professional fouling. And one of his things was, if somebody takes out, you know, if somebody badly fouls one of our players, don't go after him in the next 10 minutes, because the referee will spot it. And also, if the guy who's fouled is not to go after him, it was the captain's job to delegate somebody else to go after that guy and to remind everybody about 15 minutes later. So yeah, so if they did it,
take turns.
Yeah, if they did it at crappy schoolboy level, I'm sure the more professional level they did it. So
just summed up one of the things that's wrong with Scottish football.
Yes,
I remember. Do you know what I remember getting told?
Yes, players have been encouraged to assault each other.
I remember it being told at under 15 level. Now, as a goalkeeper, so I didn't do it. But the same, it was the same coach telling us about this pre-season. I remember him telling us about, now I need to start telling you about some of the, it was more of a coming of age thing. And his other thing was, if the opposition had a really speedy player, if you manage to rake your studs down his heel in the first 5 minutes and really get him at his Achilles, that's where the fluid builds up, and after about 20 minutes he'll struggle to run.
Good Lord, it's between you and Simon Ferry. We're getting everything that's wrong with Scottish football. Mm-hmm.
The other thing about the Clyde game, just to close on that match, is that Bobby Lennox got a hat-trick, and it was the third season in a row that he'd scored a hat-trick in the home fixture against Clyde. I mean, he really did torture them. And that put Lennox on 15 goals for the season as at the 8th of September, because he'd hit a few in the Drybera Cup. He'd scored in all the League Cup section games. He was really off to a flyer, and he was 31 years old. And there was only three Lisbon Lions left, Jinky, Big Billy, and Bobby Lennox. And Bobby Lennox ended up having a great season in 73-74. And he overtook Stevie Chalmers to become the Celtic's top goal scorer since World War II.
Yeah.
And, he still had a few seasons left in him.
Right. Played against Real Madrid in 79-80.
Played in the 80, played in the Riot Cup final.
Exactly.
Yep.
So that's the first three games we win. Win at Ibrox with a jinky header. Then we go to St Johnstone and lose 2-1.
Do you know what? I remember that day. I'll tell you why. That was the game after Scotland qualified for the World Cup finals. They beat Czechoslovakia on the Wednesday night. It was live in television, which was a huge event in those days, because live telly, live games were few and far between. There was five Celtic players in that team. There was Ali Hunter, Danny McGrain, George Connolly, Kenny Dalglish and Davy Hay. So, half the team, in essence, were Celtic players. And I remember my dad, who wasn't very... He went to very few Scotland games. He didn't really get... he wasn't enamoured with Scotland. He was animated that night because we qualified, and he became even more animated a fortnight later when England didn't qualify, because he did not dislike England. He disliked Alf Ramsey and Alf Ramsey's tactics. So I remember being up the town with my mum and dad at that St Johnstone game, and on the way back, if we wanted to know the score, we bought an Evening Times, and it says in the front page, Saints stunned Celts, and we lost 2-1. But St Johnstone was a good team at the time. But I think that was the same day that Hearts beat Rangers 3-0 at Ibrox. So I actually recall it more for Rangers losing at home 3-0 at Ibrox, and rather than the St Johnstone tie. But the recollection is that it was the game after that. There was so much excitement in the Scottish game at that point that we were going to get to the World Cup finals. And as a wee boy who was still at primary school at the time, that was such an exciting prospect.
Yeah, on those two games, I mean, the night against Czechoslovakia, I was at the game with my dad up the Celtic end. My dad was more Irish than Scottish, but even he was emotional at the end that night, and the atmosphere at Hampden was immense. When Joe Jordan scored the winner, I mean, Arthur Montfort's commentary would still put hairs in the back of my neck.
Legend.
It's just legendary stuff. And but the game, the reason I remember the game at Perth, and I don't really remember the game at all, but the supporters bus that I was on tended to cut things a bit fine, even for away games. And we got up to Perth, and one of my dad's friends, Joe, was with me, and he was a wee guy, but he'd been a boxer, I think, in his days. So when we got there, there was big queues outside at the turnstiles. It was it was disastrous, and it was already 5-3, and it looked like we were going to be struggling to get in, except at the parent and child gate, where there was only a few people. So Joe grabs me and he says, right, Robert, we're getting in here. And I said, I'm at least 6 feet two, even that year, when Joe's half my size. And he just picked me up and launched me over the turnstile and then passed over his 40 pence or whatever it was to get in. And then we made the kickoff, but I don't know how he didn't have a heart attack lifting me up. I suppose I was a skinny 6 feet two. Oh, we lost the game 2-1, and it was actually that was our only league defeat up until Christmas.
There's a guy called Jim Pearson who scored that day and basically got a transfer to Everton in the back of that game because he was very impressive. And it was a lot of money in those days. I think St Johnson got something like £110,000-£120,000 for Jim Pearson. And he did okay in England, but he wasn't that great, but he was especially good that day, and it basically got my transfer to Everton.
Yeah, you mentioned there, Robert, about that was the only defeat until Christmas, and that's the odd thing about this season. I mean, we'll go through the league results, but it's a really good first half of the league campaign, and then we win fewer than half the games out of the last 16 league games that season. We win 7 and lose or draw 8. It's an odd league campaign. We after the St Johnson game, we beat Motherwell, Dundee, we draw at home to Hibs, beat Hearts, East Fife, A United, and then there's a game against Partick Thistle, which we'll touch on in a minute. Beat Dumbarton, beat Arbroath, draw with Dundee United, beat Falkirk, beat Dunfermline, beat Clyde, and then we got on to the January Rangers game. During all of that time was amazing turmoil. We've already, on and off the park at Celtic, we've already touched on the turmoil a bit off it with state of emergency in the UK. I mean, actually, this is good to be doing this in the middle of lockdown, because it gives you an idea of when you were in the middle of this, it must have felt like the world was ending. Yet, when you look back, that was the 3-day week. And I suppose it's a bit similar to this lockdown stuff. When you're in the middle of it, it's like, this is never ending. You had the state of emergency. You had games kicking off at 1:30. You had some evening games because Hampden, for example, had its own generators. Then, as we've already touched on, games had to be moved because they weren't allowed to use generators because they were running out of power for coal to be able to do independent generators. You had transport strikes. You had major events in Govan with Margot MacDonald winning the Govan by-election. So the SNP, there's one for the Govan, the Govan boy.
Listen, I can come in there.
And the SNP boy.
I'll tell you a funny story about that. Our door went and I went to answer it, and Margot MacDonald was standing there with a few SNP supporters, and she says, "Is your mammy in, son?" And I didn't know who she was, and I said, "Mum, there's a lady at the door for you." So my mum comes out, and that was the first time my mother had ever heard of the word creche. Margot MacDonald said to my mother, "I'm not asking you who you're voting for. All I'm saying is, as a female, are you able to get to to vote? Because if you can't, I can arrange to get you transport there, and your son will be looked after at the creche." Mum, I didn't know what a creche was, right? And she told the truth. She said, "There's no problem with voting. I'm an only child. You know, she could take me quite easily." But my mother was very impressed with Margot MacDonald. I don't think she voted for her, I have to say, but she was very impressed with her, because she was ahead of her time, in as much as she was getting out there and she was communicating with women who might otherwise have problems in voting. And it wasn't really a surprise when she won that election. Although sadly for Margot MacDonald, I think that would have been around about November 73 she won that.
November 73, yeah.
And then the general election came in March and she lost the seat. The seat went back to Labour. That she was chatting old-fashioned politics, chatting doors, communicating with people face-to-face, and it worked for them.
Yeah, I think when it came to the general election, and of course there was a miners' strike happening, and, you know, that was just making the fuel problems and power problems in the UK, you know, even worse. And it seems incredible now to note that the miners were offered a pay increase of 16.5%, which they turned down. But inflation in Britain at that time was running at 15-20%, hence the fact that they rejected it. And under some formula which had been agreed the year before, they were supposed to get a 35% pay increase.
Wow.
And when Ted Heath wasn't forthcoming, that's when they went out on strike. And general election at the end of February, which actually the Conservatives won the election, but they couldn't, they didn't have enough to form a government, and Harold Wilson formed a minority government and immediately paid the miners the 35%, which finished the strike and finished the three-day week, which had been going on for a couple of months, two or three months. So it was, it was interesting times in, you know, in the British economy at that time.
I think the election was bought on the slogan of "Who governs Britain?"
Yeah. I think the guy, there was a guy who was one of the miners' leaders, was Mick McGahey.
Mick McGahey.
A guy from, he wasn't the ultimate leader, but I think he was the leader of the Scottish miners. And he came up with a classic quote, because he said he was going to put the army in. And McGahey said, yeah, good luck, you can't dig coal with bayonets. So
So what was, how did you find living in Britain at that time, Lackey? And were you an SNP man at that time? Just thinking of Malcolm MacDonald winning.
I always supported the SNP all my life. My mother used to say to me, aye, you vote for the SNP, you're voting for the Orange Lodge. And I went to...
don't forget also that Home Rule is Rome Rule.
Exactly. I went to Pastor Jack Glass's election meeting when he was running for Parliament. We went to this election meeting down. They started in Normanagh and they made their way to Glasgow Green. This is the truth. And I went with this other teacher who was an English guy. And we were sort of standing at the side of the road. We could see Ramayana's up. Now, a lot of the kids knew us from St. Mary's. And I said to the other teacher, they've rumbled us, you know. I think they know what we are. But the guy came over and he says, this is honest truth. There was an orange band, and they were having a parade, and he says, I fixed it with a pastor, lads. Yous can smoke in the ranks. fair enough. So we joined this procession to Glasgow Green. And at Glasgow Green, he made much of the fact that a loyal orange Dutchman had defeated the Papists at the Battle of the Boyne, and another 11 loyal Dutchmen had beat us in Milan. Yes, it was very much a case of a vote for Home Rule as a vote for Rome Rule. Mm. That was on the banners.
So,
just on the football.
Yeah, I was gonna say. So, at the same time, we had a player on strike.
Yeah,
he missed. We talked earlier about the 0-0 Aberdeen game. He missed the Aberdeen game away, 0-0 at Pittodrie, on strike, and George Connolly had disappeared.
That's correct.
George,
not for the first time.
In sympathy, he kind of went on strike as well in sympathy with David Hayes' position. David Hayes says in his book, we talked about McCarrie in the last podcast and the fact that they wouldn't give McCarrie £100 a week. Well, David Hay was also looking for £100 a week, and he was on 65 at that time. And the arithmetic would say that that would have been an extra £1,820 a year cost to the club to keep a player who was going to have an outstanding World Cup in West Germany. And, you know, £1,820 wasn't a lot of money.
You've already made the point, Robert, about the inflation. What did you say it was there? 15-20%. So, yeah. I mean, David Hay and the other players, not just Celtic players, would have had good cause in the days to go to the clubs and say, you know, wait a minute here, that the prices are rising so much, so our wages, just like the miners were saying, have to be put up accordingly.
Yeah, and I'm sure the prices of entry into the ground was also, you know, inching up as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, giving McCarrie £100 a week would have cost us £5,000 a year.
Mm.
And for less than £2,000 a year, we could have kept David Hay happy. And I think the Desmond White position was, well, then everybody is going to want £100 a week. And presumably Dalglish wasn't getting paid that at that time either. And
according to Potter and who's the other
Campbell.
Guy? Campbell. The year I could Harry Hood was on 125. And this was part of the issue, that there were players who were being paid more than £100 a week.
But David, well, we did try to dump Harry Hood that season.
Yeah.
But that's not the point. The point is, they're saying to these young players who are international players with vast potential that their wage scale is limited. But there were other players in the squad who were getting paid more than £100 a week.
But the bottom dollar is that if you give McCarrie an extra five, and if you give Davy Hay an extra 2,000, and say you give Dalglish and Danny and George Connolly, you know, so your team of the future, you know, even if it all adds up to £10,000-£12,000 a year, you then compare that with paying 35,000 for Andy Lynch.
Yes.
50,000.
It was a false economy, Robert.
25,000 for Jimmy Bone. Yeah. And you think, where should we have spent the money?
Correct. Correct. Absolutely. Now, the other thing as well here, and Robert touched on this there, Jock Stein was desperate to get John Duncan around about autumn of 1973 from Dundee. John Duncan was a smashing player. And as it happened, he eventually went to Spurs for quite a lot of money. But I remember that there was a lot of... It was as if Jock was trying to overhaul the team. He went for Ian Phillip from Crystal Palace. Ian Phillip had played for Dundee and ironically ended up back with Dundee. And he didn't get Ian Phillip. He didn't get John Duncan. And a very strange one as well. He was also said to have made a bid for a Motherwell player called Jim McCabe, who I don't have much recollection of Jim McCabe, and he seems to have disappeared from the radar very quickly, considering that Celtic and Jock Stein wanted to sign him. And I often think back how things might have changed had we got John Duncan, had we got Ian Phillip, because these would have been good additions to the squad. Certainly, they probably would have walked into the team at that time because they were very capable players. And I think Jock was very frustrated and twofold, that the board wouldn't back him for giving the players more money and they were becoming unhappy. And he also weren't backing them in the transfer market because he was having to go for Andy Lynch and Jimmy Bone, who, with the greatest respect, were, in my opinion, were never Celtic players.
Andy Lynch was a good player. Andy Lynch was a decent footballer.
No, in a left wing, though. He never made a mark. In his true position.
He didn't for Celtic, but he was a good player for Hearts.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see why they signed him.
But we had Paul Wilson.
Yeah, I know, but you could understand why they signed him. Paul Wilson started part of the appearances in the team.
Part of the Lynch deal was Rab Prentice leaving us, right?
Who was also a good player.
He was a fantastic winger, similar to Paul Wilson, but not such a good goal scorer.
Uh-huh. I mean, it's easy to dismiss Andy Lynch because it didn't work out for him as a winger. But he was a decent Celtic player.
No, the only point I'm making, Lachie, is I loved Andy Lynch. I thought he was terrific. All I'm saying is I don't think he was any better than what we had there, which I think is what Robert's maybe alluding to also.
Perhaps, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So within that run that we just talked about, and during this period of daytime kickoffs, and we'll move shortly on to Sunday kickoffs happening for the first time. In the middle of that, we played a game, and the Celtic team was Hunter McGrain, Quinn, McCluskey, McNeil, Murray, Lennox, Hood, Deans, Callaghan, and Dalglish. Now, Bobby Lennox scored one goal in the game I'm about to speak about, and Dixie Deans scored six goals. So, who was at Celtic 7, Partick Thistle 0, with Dixie Deans scoring six goals?
I was in the jungle that day, and we sang Dixie Deans' name almost from start to finish. I can't quite remember when he got his sixth and how much time was left, because the story is that Jimmy McGrory was sitting in the director's box watching the match, and Jimmy McGrory held the all-time Scottish record for having scored eight goals in a game against Dunfermline in the late 1920s. and reading a report, it was, as you know, McGrory's record was in some danger. I'm not sure if that's right. I have a feeling that one of Dixie's goals was very late on. I love Deans. I absolutely loved them. I think partly because of the penalty miss against Inter Milan and the way he responded and rebounded from that adversary. And, you know, he's such a wholehearted player, great goal scorer. And that was just a wonderful day. And I remember getting off the bus after the match in Great Western Road, and everybody that asked me the score when I was walking home, I said 7-0, Dean's got six. That was my answer to everybody. Yeah. We won 7-0 and Dixie scored six. And he was really in a great vein of form. He scored four against Falkirk in the following month. And, you know, he finished the season with 33 goals. And he had missed quite a few matches that season. Mm-hmm. So yeah. A bit like Bobby Lennox. You know,
it was actually quite a nondescript game. Because it was a gloomy November day. Partick weren't getting any great opposition at the time. It may have been one of those 2 o'clock kickoffs because of the floodlights and stuff. I'd need to check that up. I'd need to look that up. But what became apparent was, as Dixie started to score the goals, the crowd responded. So when you get a hat trick, you know, that's terrific. When you score a hat trick, that's an achievement. You're getting the ball. And then they get four, and the crowd went mad. And then they get five. And I remember the jungle chat, and each time you score, we want five, and then you get five, and then it was, we want six, and then you get six. So Dixie actually made what would have been quite a nondescript, uneventful game, something that we're talking about almost 50 years later, with some affection, because it was quite a... And Dixie was very magnanimous after the game, because you've got guys like Lennox and Dalglish, you know, almost putting a ball on a plate for him, and he could have had more that day. From memory, I think he missed a couple.
Yeah, I mean, the previous season that fixture had been one each at Parkhead, mm-hmm. and Alan Rufford had a great game. So Thistle generally weren't such a pushover at that time. They still had a pretty good team. In fact, they beat us in the return game at Firhill in March. They got some revenge. That was a memorable game, the match against Thistle.
Yeah. So we beat Thistle, Dixie Dean scores six, and one of the other things about this, we talked last week about how many goals Dixie Dean scored at Celtic, and then he scored 33 goals this season. And maybe it's just the nature of, you know, certain players, like Chris Boyd scored lots of goals, but people didn't see him as a rounded player to be doing that much. Dixie Dean's had two caps for Scotland. Mm.
And they got two caps.
Yes, and they both came the next season.
Yeah. After he scored the hat trick against Hibs in the League Cup final, I think he was capped twice.
That's right. So he still hadn't been capped at this point.
Yeah, hadn't been capped.
But I can't.
He didn't go to the World Cup because no. Donald Ford Arts went to the World Cup in West Germany.
He was named in the 40 though, and I always think that 40-man squad's a bit of a misnomer, because it just gives people false hope. I mean, if you're named in the 40, you're hoping you're going to be in the 22, and really, there was a lot of players in there just making up the numbers. But Dixie and Bobby Lennox were in the World Cup 40 before it got whittled down to the 22. And as it happened, we had four Celtic players in the 22. George Connolly would definitely have been at the World Cup, although he broke his leg in March. And Ali Hunter, interestingly enough, didn't even make the 40 after his blunder against Czechoslovakia in September of 73.
Well, that's something I'm going to talk about, because it's sort of generally talked about that Ali Hunter was going to be a great Celtic goalkeeper. Blunders against against Czechoslovakia. And that's really pinpointed as the start of the end of his career. Lackey, any thoughts on that?
I think this has become almost like a cliche that everybody agrees with that. It certainly seemed to affect his confidence. He played on for Celtic for a wee while, and he did play the odd good game. But I mean, there wasn't a lot of opposition to him at Celtic Park at the time, because Edwin Williams was out of favour, and Dennis Corrigan was never a real challenger. But he was never the goalkeeper they expected him to be. I think we talked last week that Steen reckoned to be there for 10 years. Well, that just didn't happen.
So I bet you there was no goalkeeping coach.
No.
I mean, they just, goalkeepers would run round the track with the rest of the team and then people would fire shots at them. So there was no element of development of goalkeepers, you know, so it didn't really matter whether it was Ali Hunter or Evan Williams or Dennis Conaghan. You know, they weren't really being coached properly after we signed them.
Because Hunter was still in the team after the Czechoslovakia game, right through until, I would say, February, when he got injured. And I would say it was the injury at that time that curtailed his career, rather than the mistake against Czechoslovakia. Certainly the Czech thing affected him at an international level, but in terms of club level, Dennis Conaghan actually became the goalkeeper for February onwards, and we'll talk about it later on, but he does rather well.
Well, my memory as a Celtic fan was that it was Dennis Conaghan was the goalkeeper. Ali Hunter was not liked by the fans, and then Peter Latchford gets signed. But that's in subsequent seasons. But that's so we go through, and we're no longer playing Rangers on New Year's Day following the Ibrox disaster. We beat Clyde, and then we away, and then we play Rangers on the 5th of January. And we beat them 1-0 at Celtic Park. Lackey, were you? Did you manage to make that game?
Yes, I did. Yeah. Bobby Leonard scored.
Yes.
The Rangers complained. Yes. I watched it again on television the other day, and the pass through to Harry Hood. They debated that Harry Hood was in an offside position when he got it. It was a very scrappy goal, I remember rightly. But it was a winner against Rangers, so it might. Quite happy with that.
And I saw that game in TV, and I can't believe that it finished 1-0. I mean, we should have won 3 or 4-0 that day.
It did. It battered them.
I was at, and one of the things I remember most, sorry, Robert, one of the things I remember most was, I think it was the Lewis Rand on the right wing. They were shooting into the Celtic end, and he squared the ball right across the goal, and Dean was right in front of the goal, and he put the ball in the bar. and ironically, enough, he never scored against Rangers, and that was his chance. And that one sticks in my mind. It was a terrible miss.
It was a 2 o'clock kickoff that day, again, trying to accommodate things, and it was the 3-day week had just started, actually, at that time.
I'm still not sure that 2 o'clock kickoff accommodated anything, because it's dark at 3 o'clock in January. You know, there was no logic to it at all. You know, I read somewhere that they even banned the use of generators. They didn't want to be using, because they used petrol or diesel or whatever it was. But the idea of having a kickoff at 2 o'clock in some way to take advantage of daylight in December is absurd. It really is.
So,
you know what I remember about that? I went to the Jungle. It's the first time I'd been to the Jungle for an Old Firm game. And remember being surprised by how many Rangers fans were in the Jungle on their side.
It was divided. It was equal, more or less equal.
I was going to say two-thirds third, but you might be right there.
Was there an old ticket, was it? Was it an old ticket game, was it?
Don't think so. No, I think, most of my life, most of the first 15, 20 years of my life, it was pay at the door for Celtic Rangers games.
You had to get a ticket for the stand.
Yes.
You could pay at the door for the terrace.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the crowd, was 55,000. So, you know, as we commented last week, the crowds were in decline, you know, for league games, for Old Firm games, everything was in decline. As we discussed last week, about partly due to hooliganism, but this season, I think, certainly due to the economic environment and the restrictions and what was a particularly cold winter, I recall.
So we beat Rangers, and we'll pause the league campaign there because the Scottish Cup finished before the league. So the Scottish Cup, again, getting back on my hobby horse that I'm noticing in this nine in a row. We're drawing at home. The furthest we travel is a replay against Motherwell. We are at home to Clydebank 6-1. We are at home to Stirling Albion 6-1. We are at home to Motherwell draw 2-2. We then have a replay. We have a replay 1-0. We win. Semi-final, we beat Dundee 1-0, and then the final, we beat Dundee United 3-0. So, Lackey, were you at any of the Scottish Cup games?
Yeah. The first game was a Sunday game. I think it was a Sunday game against Clydebank. They won 6-1. I actually have a kind of a wee narrative about this Scottish Cup campaign. I went to see, it's the only time I've ever paid to go and see Rangers when Celtic were on the plane. And they drew Dundee in the early rounds of the Cup. It was a Sunday afternoon game at Ibrox. And Irene had two friends who lived across the road from me. And they were going, there were a couple of twins called the Curley twins. So I'd met them at Mass, and they said they were going to Ibrox. I said, I'll come too. So we went across, and Dundee annihilated them. Dundee thrashed them 3-0. And I thought, they're a really good side, because they beat the Celtic in the League Cup. And John Duncan, that Stephen referred to, had a terrific game. So they drew the Hibs at Easter Road in the next round. And there was a guy working with me called Eddie Haggerty. I think he's chairman of Albion Rovers or something now. He and I went through to Easter Road to watch it, and it was a wonderful game, an absolutely magnificent game of football. It was 3-3. And then Dundee won the replay. So when Dundee drew Celtic in the semi-final, I'm saying to my brother, well, they're a really good team. They'll be hard to beat. And Celtic played terrific and beat them in the semi-final. But that was, I'd actually seen Dundee three times in that campaign, including the game they played the Celtic.
I think the day Rangers lost at home to Dundee that Sunday, we played as well. We were playing Stirling Albion, but I think the kickoff times were totally different at Parkhead and Ibrox, because I don't remember so much about the six goals we scored against Stirling Albion, but I remember tremendous excitement in the jungle when news came through, and it came, I think it came through very early on in our game, that Dundee had won 3-0 at Ibrox. So I think maybe one of the games might have kicked off around 12, and the other one...
That game at Ibrox, it shows you how popular the Sunday games were initially. The Dundee game at Ibrox, and you can look this up, I'm sure it was something like 64,000.
Yeah.
What was it, that game? Now that's phenomenal for a Rangers-Dundee game. And in the quarter-finals, Celtic played Motherwell on a Sunday, and there was 48,000 at it. Now, we've already spoken about how the game's in decline and how attendances are going down. And there was a wee spell there where the Sunday games were proving very popular. But interestingly enough, they never really caught on, and it was a good few years before it happened again. I've got to say that my dad didn't like Sunday games. I remember going to Mass on a Sunday morning and feeling quite excited about going to the Celtic game against Clydebank in the first one, and he just felt that it destroyed his weekend, because he wanted to go to the football on a Saturday. He wanted to go for maybe a wee drink on a Saturday night, and then just have the Sunday to relax and have a family meal at tea time, the vast majority of the country did in those days and Sundays. And he didn't like the fact that this was interrupting his weekend. He felt lost on a Saturday, and he felt as if going to the football on a Sunday wasn't the done thing.
Was there any truth in the story that Rangers were initially objecting to Sunday football on religious grounds?
I don't know. Possibly.
Given the Protestant support, possibly, because the Is it the wee frees that refuse to do things on Sunday and they don't like to even recreation on Sundays?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The day we beat Clyde Bank, Rangers had played at home in the Scottish Cup the day before, and certainly something I read was that Rangers, you know, were about the last team to be convinced in Scotland that they should adopt Sunday football, and clearly they did for that Dundee game, which went rather badly for them.
It probably seemed a very Roman thing to do, very continental, you know. So it wouldn't have appealed to poor support.
Spain and Italy, yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting to comment on, you know, why did Rangers have such a bad season, given that they had finished the previous season on a 26-game unbeaten run and beaten us in the Scottish Cup final and beaten us in the league. And at the start of this season, they had, you know, they'd beaten us at Parkhead and, you know, split the points really in the two Old Firm games. And you look at their first, the start of their league campaign was just disastrous. They had four home games in the league. I think their first four home games were Ayr United, us, Hearts and East Fife. And Rangers didn't score a single goal.
They took one out of eight. One of my happiest memories as a boy was hearing that I don't remember who we played, to be honest, but I remember hearing that East Fife beat Rangers at Ibrox. Never forget it. That sticks in my mind, you know, very much.
So later in the season, I think after Christmas, they lost at home to Arbroath. So that's a bit of Arbroath and East Fife. So their league challenge never really got going. They were back in the Cup Winners' Cup.
They signed a guy called Doug Houston, who was a very good player for Dundee.
Yes.
And he cost quite a lot of money. I think he was in a par with what we paid for Stevie Murray to Aberdeen. So Doug Houston must have played very, very few games for Rangers. And I don't know if he got injured or his face didn't fit. But he was a big disappointment for them at the beginning of the season because he was meant to be their main man in midfield and it never materialised.
I mean, the other thing we talked last week about how Hibs it the season before when they were en route to a possible quadruple and won two games out of the last 16 competitive fixtures or something like that. It's an odd season actually because I don't know whether all the off the park stuff also affected the players because Hibs finished second. I mean, the league finished. Celtic, Hibs, Rangers, Aberdeen, Dundee, Hearts, Ayr, Dundee United, Motherwell, Dumbarton, Partick Thistle, St Johnson, Arbroath, Morton, Clyde, Dunfermline, East Fife and Falkirk. And Hibs finished second to us but had an all over the place season in that I don't think they strung more than four wins together, yet they managed to finish second. They would win three, draw one, win three, lose one, win three, draw one. Rangers had that run that you just talked about. And even Celtic, I mean, if we dip back into the league for a minute, we lost on the 2nd of February, 10th of February, 23rd of March, drew on the 30th of March, and then drew our last four league games of the season. So it's a funny season.
But the last three draws were dead rubbers.
They were academic.
The league was won. At one point, I think when we lost in consecutive weeks at Fir Park and then at home to Dundee in February, we then kind of headed to Easter Road. And if Hibs had beaten us, I think the gap would have been down to one or two points. So it would have been interesting. And it was one of the great Hibs-Celtic matches many great Hibs-Celtic matches at that time. And we beat them 4-2. The crowd was nearly 50,000, which is almost unimaginable for Easter Road. But it was a cracking day. Dixie again got a couple. And I think that finished Hibs' challenge. And I think after that game, we were 5 or 6 points ahead. And we strolled to the title.
Mm-hmm. Paul Wilson scored that day. And I remember that was the first time that Paul had really made an impact. He'd come in for the odd game, but he was never really a regular. But round about this period, from about the new year onwards, Paul begins to play more, he gets more games, and he scored a few vital goals as well. And that the certainly I remember him scoring in that 4-2 game at Easter Road, a very important goal.
Yeah, if I'd nip back into the league, because we'll do the league and then the cup final, we beat Hibs after losing at home to Dundee and losing away to Motherwell. We beat Hibs 4-2, Hearts, United. After beating Thistle 7-0 at Celtic Park, we then lose 2-0 at Fir Hill. Draw with Dumbarton 3-each at Celtic Park. Then beat Arbroath, beat Dundee United, beat East Fife, beat Aberdeen, and then we win the title with a 1-1 draw at Brockville against Falkirk. So, Lackey, any specific memories of those league games and of tying the title up at Brockville?
Not really. I got married on the 15th of April, so I was busy going on honeymoon and things like that towards the end of the season, and setting up a new home in Airdrie and painting and decorating and stuff. So I think the only game I really remember after the Atletico Madrid game would have been the cup final.
And what about you, Robert? Do you have a memory of those games? Did you get to Brockville for the league title triumph?
Yeah, I was at Brockville and was there with one of my mates from school, and we were in the very front row at a corner flag, and Dalglish scored a great goal to get us the draw, which was all we needed. And actually that put Falkirk down, that result. And at the final whistle, me and my mate Joe Hygent, we ran onto the pitch, and we were amongst the first to run onto the pitch. And when I got back home, 8 o'clock or something like that, my mum wasn't too happy because she'd been watching either Grandstand or the wrestling or something like that. And they must have cut to the last few seconds at Brockville or showed it on a delayed live. And she saw me and Joe running onto the pitch. And I don't remember much about being on the pitch and just kind of waving my scarf. And, you know, a lot of people ran on, but I don't think I was on the pitch for very long. And it was something I only ever repeated once, and that was Love Street 86, which just half the stadium was on the pitch after that one. So, yeah, that was great. 9 in a row. I think it was a bit... Yeah, we were really just taking it for granted. And I think because Rangers had been so poor and so inconsistent, you know...
The Falkirk game wasn't a great celebration, though, because that came only a few days after we'd been eliminated by Atletico. I don't want to go into that because I know we'll talk about that in detail. But if you see that the pictures of the Celtic players after the game, they're still quite a haunted look in their face. I think that the Atletico game, we had a hangover for that game for many, many months to come. Now, the Falkirk game, I remember my dad had just learned to drive and he had a car. And we went to pick up my aunt in Paisley High Street because she worked in Boots. And he had a wee transistor radio in the car. And I remember we were very excited that we won the league. You know, 9 in a row was a great achievement. But I also remember the news coming through that Manchester United were relegated that day. Man City beat them at Old Trafford. And this was huge news, even in Scotland, you know, that this would have been quite a momentous thing to happen. But just going back to one of the games before that, Thistle beat us 2-0 at Fir Hill, and Ronnie Glavin scored 2 cracking goals. And for that game onwards, Steen chased Glavin like mad. It took months to get him for a whole number of reasons, probably because we wouldn't pay the money that Thistle wanted, knowing that the Celtic board. But Glavin was terrific that day. And my other memory of that day is that Stevie Chalmers played against Celtic. And even in 1974, when he was coming to the later stages of his career, he was a handful that day for the Celtic defence.
That's right.
So we've tied up 9 in a row titles. I'm gonna save the Scottish Cup final till last. So we'll skip on to European football, onto the European campaign. So we beat Turku of Finland, 6-1 there, 3-0 at Celtic Park. We play Danish team, can't pronounce them, BK.
Velia.
only nil. I mean, we scraped through in that one. 0-0 at Celtic Park. 1-0 over there to go through. Then Basel of Switzerland, which for quite a number of people that I know, that are just, you know, a couple of years older than me, this is one of their first real memories of a big Celtic game. We lose 3-2 away in Switzerland and win 4-2 at Celtic Park. And then there's the Atletico games, which we'll touch on in a minute. So, first of all, Robert, any, and actually, St. Anthony, any memories of those European games?
The Velia game and the home game, Jimmy Johnson was made captain, which was very, very unusual. And it leads me to think that there must have been a weakened team if Chinky was the captain, because if Billy wasn't there, then probably George Conley would have got it, or maybe even, you know, Jim Brogan, or one of the more experienced players, Davy Hay. So we didn't play well that night, and they got a lot of criticism for that. However, in the second leg, and maybe Robert or George will be able to verify this, I remember watching, it was a tea time kickoff, and I remember watching Scotland Today, and it showed you the Celtic goal. That's all it showed you. It just said the latest score from Denmark is 1-0. Here is a goal by Bobby Lennox. And I remember my dad saying at that point, that's us through, because they'll never, away goals, they'll never score twice against us. And from memory, it was a fairly comfortable 1-0 win, as comfortable as you can get in the circumstances. But the ball games were really exciting. The first game, I remember watching it in the telly, and to this day, my heart breaks for Evan Williams. He had a nightmare. I'm sure Evan Williams caused the three goals. They were pitiful. There was one in particular that went under his body that a 10-year-old would have saved it. And that was the end of the line for Evan. He'd get back into the team, I think, following Ali Hunter's injury. And I just remember, even as a young boy, my heart went out to him. It was devastating. You just knew that was the end of the line for Evan Williams. And we scored two cracking goals in Switzerland, and we threw three in. So it actually made the second leg exciting. And we went 2-0 up at a home game, and the same thing happened again. We lost two crap goals. And it took a Tommy Callaghan goal to get us to extra time, and a very, very dramatic header by Stevie Murray won it in extra time. And in later years, I recall Stevie Murray talking about that. And do you remember his boys, if we were playing football and there wasn't a lot of space, we always played a game called what we called double headies, because, you know, just to sort of improve your heading ability. And the ball came to Stevie Murray that night, and Stevie Murray says, I had done this hundreds of times as a boy. I just leant back and I hung the ball in the air and it dropped under the crossbar. It was a fantastic goal.
The two of the Basel goals against us were scored by Omar Hitzfeld, who later won the Champions League twice as a manager with Dortmund and Bayern Munich. And yeah, all the Basel goals, I think, were shots from distance. And I mean, Dennis Connaughton did not play particularly well in the return game at Parkhead either, because we were cruising after 15 minutes, and Dixie scored a fabulous goal. There was a great passing move down the right. Not quite as good, but somewhat similar to the goal at Love Street in 86. You know, a lot of quick passing, first time finish. Great goal by Dixie, and then we let them back into it. So, fantastic night and brilliant atmosphere. Just mention of the Danish game in Vejle. They actually scored in 12 seconds, and it was disallowed for offside, which sounds a bit unlikely that you could score and be offside that quickly. But as St. Anthony says, it was a much more comfortable win than the 1-0 scoreline suggested. So that was us in the semis, and semis for the fourth time in eight seasons. So Atletico Madrid, champions of Spain, not as glamorous as Real Madrid and or Barcelona, who by that stage, I think, had signed Cruyff. And, you know, Atletico Madrid had five clean sheets in six games in the tournament. So they'd knocked out Galatasaray, Dynamo Bucharest and Red Star Belgrade. So all Eastern European teams, but very strong defensively. Strong Argentinian contingent in the team. Their manager, Juan Carlos Lorenzo, had been the manager of Argentina in the 1966 World Cup, whom Alf Ramsey had criticised animals. I think Big Jock kind of knew what was coming. And, you know, we had no George Connolly, no Danny McGrain, no Lennox, but we... I was in the jungle that night as well. We totally dominated the game. We had many decent chances when it was still 11 aside, and you know, a number of chances as the red cards were produced. He sent off three Atletico players in the second half. One of them was Ruben Ayala, who was a striker who would play for Argentina in that summer's World Cup. So seven of the Atletico players got booked. We had two yellow cards. He sent off three of them. And they had 50 fouls against them in the match. So it was classic anti-football, break up the play. They had zero attacking ambition in that match. They just dug in. And one of the great memories of that game, which I could see from the jungle, but it was much, much better when you saw it on telly, was that a fight broke out at the entrance to the tunnel as the two teams were leaving the field. I think one of the Celtic players, from looking at the footage, the STV footage, I think one of the Celtic players gets booted as they're walking off. They're already off the pitch. And Pat McCluskey just launches himself into this ruck of players and decks somebody. And there's a picture, you know, in the Daily Record or the Scottish Express the day after the game. There's about three cops trying to hold Pat McCluskey back from, you know, God knows what he was going to do to these guys. And there was a good quote from Davy Hay, which said, he says, "We got kicked all night, even me, and I was the one usually kicking other people." So
That fight in the tunnel, I remember hearing an interview with Tommy Gemmell, and he said that that after that, as they were going, you know, seconds after that, the policemen who were holding people back, an Atletico player went for Tommy Gemmell, I think it was. Oh, and it wouldn't have been Tommy Gemmell.
He wasn't playing.
No, it wouldn't have been. No, I can't remember who it was. It was somebody who was talking about it, and the policeman then held the Atletico player so that the Celtic player could have a kick at him.
Yeah, well, I think that was maybe McCluskey decked, but the thing is, the next day we discovered that Atletico, apart from the three guys who'd been sent off, being banned from the second leg, there was at least another three who were out of the second leg as well, and we thought, you know, we'd been so much better than them in terms of playing football, and they had so many players out for the second leg, we thought this would be a massive advantage to us. What we hadn't appreciated was that a number of the guys who played at Parkhead weren't first team regulars, but they were just
hammer players. Been,
yeah, they'd been put in to do a hatchet job and stop us playing, stop us scoring. And, you know, they succeeded in doing that, and so they weren't really weakened at all for the second leg, which became an exercise in survival on and off the field. And there was a great quote, you know, there was famously death threats were made the day before and the day of the match against both Jimmy Johnson and Jock Stein. And I think Jinky was pretty upset, and Steen said something like, "How can they possibly shoot you, wee man, when you're zipping about all over the pitch at high speed?" He said, I'm just a huge sitting duck in the dugout, so they're bound to get me instead." So this was Big Jock trying to provide some assurance to Jinky. And I think I found some footage of the game yesterday on YouTube of the away game, and we played extremely well. And we had a number of chances, and for 75 minutes, you know, they had chances as well. And
if we'd scored first that night, we would have been through, Robert, I think.
Yeah, on away goals. And they showed that they could play in the second leg, and they had some very good players. But, you know, it took them until about 75 minutes to get the breakthrough. A number of the players said it was the most hostile atmosphere they had ever played in. Absolute frenzied. And we hit the bar, actually, at 1-0 down. And then they got a second goal, and that was us out.
But this was still Spain of the Franco generation. So apparently what happened there is their media had reported Atletico as the victims because they were treated so terribly by the Scottish, and the Scottish police had, you know, as Brian was saying there, you know, that there was the incident in the tunnel. So they used that to their own advantage to sort of highlight to the Spanish people how how hard done by they had been, that they were the victims somehow. The truth was it was the opposite. Now, the as regards the home leg, in later years, there's been a lot of criticism of Jock Stein by Celtic historians who say that when you're playing eight men, or even nine men, and then eight men, you should have had a goal at least. I mean, you would think that just sheer numerical advantage would lead to you scoring a goal at some point during the game. But I don't think people appreciate, who maybe don't remember that game, the psychological scar which that left on the Celtic players and on the club for a long, long time. Because this wasn't the way we played the game. We were used to for good footballing teams coming to Celtic Park and being applauded and respected. And to see this, these villains, if I can describe them as that, it just went against everything that as football fans that we believed in. And it took a long, long time to get that out of our system.
Lackey, did you manage to get to the game?
Yeah, I did. I was in the jungle that night.
Were you incensed?
Well, I mean, it was astonishing what they did. I mean, I thought, a bit like Stephen, saying that it did leave a scar in the Celtic. I think as much because there was a sense of injustice that a team could come and so have so little regard for the game and for the rules of the game that they should even be allowed to proceed. So there was a sense that if UEFA had any moral fibre at all, they would simply have put them out of the competition. Because what they did was bringing the game into disrepute in the worst possible way. And they were the champions of Spain. So it was always going to be a difficult game against them in Madrid. And the whole thing with the death threats and things heightened the tension. And they are notoriously fanatical, support Atletico Madrid. I think they're the support of the working class in Madrid. I don't think they'll get any great admiration for Franco in the way that Real Madrid were Franco's team. But there certainly was a hostile atmosphere, and they, as Stephen said, they made out the Celtic were the villains. But I think that sense of disbelief that you had, they even asked you to go and play the second game. Mm-hmm. We were denied the opportunity to play football in the first game. And some of the tackles were savage. I mean, I'm surprised nobody was badly injured that night. It was shocking. But it just made if the game's that important, what's the point, you know?
I think we had plenty chances to win that game and to win that game by two or three goals.
Yes.
Their goalkeeper on the night, Reina, Miguel Reina, was the father of Pepe Reina that played for Liverpool a few years ago. I think he's still playing for Aston Villa, actually. And so I think Atletico just defended for their lives. And even with seven outfield players, you know, they made it difficult for us.
Yeah, but Inter Milan, was it last year or the previous year?
Yep.
They defended for their lives with discipline and
order
and kept the ball when they needed to keep the ball. They maybe didn't threaten us too much, but they knew how to play proper football. Atletico Madrid made no attempt to play football that night.
Mm-hmm.
It was an absolute scar on the game that they were allowed to proceed to the final.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when they got a goal kick, they just booted the ball up the park to us and immediately conceded possession and let us start again.
There's actually footage on YouTube, and funnily enough, I don't remember this at the game, but you can see it clearly. Dalglish actually scores a good goal. Harry Hood gets to the byline, and he just manages to keep the ball in play and squares it, and Dalglish scores. And it takes about 6 or 7 seconds for everything to die down and realise that the linesman had flagged that the ball had went out of play. Now, when you put it in slow motion, I don't think there's any way that ball's out of play. It certainly wasn't a clear decision. That linesman could not have been certain in his mind that ball was out. So, again, looking back, that would have changed the whole dynamics of that game. And maybe Atletico would have had to come out at that point. I don't know, but it would have put us in a stronger position and given us something to hang on to in the second leg. And I have this fervent belief that we would have beat Bayern Munich in the final. I know that it's an easy thing to say, and that Bayern Munich had Beckenbauer and they had Gerd Müller and Hoeneß and Sepp Maier. But having seen the three finals that Bayern won, in each of the games they were very vulnerable at different stages of the game. And in 1974, Dalglish is coming to the fore. We've got Dixie Deans, Jimmy Johnson come back into the team in a really high form. You've got Stevie Murray, you've got Danny McGrain, Davy Hay, who became a great player in the World Cup finals. We were approaching a peak in 1974, and I do think, and I know it's dead easy to say, that we would have had a great chance of beating Bayern in that final.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, they had 6 players that played in the World Cup final just 3 months later. But if you look at Bayern's path to the final, and I mentioned already Atletico Madrid had 5 clean sheets in 6 games en route to playing us. Bayern, on the other hand, first round, they beat the Swedish champions at Widerberg 4-4 on aggregate. Bayern won by a penalty shootout. Second round, 7-6 on aggregate against Dynamo Dresden. Quarter-final, 5-3 on aggregate against CSKA Sofia. So not hugely impressive, but then impressively they beat Ujpest Doza 4-1 on aggregate in the semis. So this was a team that scored a lot because, of course, they had Müller and Hoeneß. But they conceded a lot of goals and they were within 30 seconds of losing the final.
I remember that moment vividly, and I'll never forget the guy's name. He was called George Schwarzenbeck, and what a goal he scored. It was a 30-yarder right out of the blue, and I remember my dad went mental that night with joy because the dislike of Atletico Madrid was so much, and that dislike of Atletico Madrid sticks to this day. I was in Spain on holiday in 2014 when Atletico... It was at 13 or 14, it may be 13. Atletico got to the final against Real. And my son was about 8 or 9 at the time, football mad still is. And we went out for a family meal to this wee bar and we started to watch that game. And Atletico were winning right into injury time. And the more bottles of beer that I had, I was becoming more seething. The prospect of this club, even after all the years, winning that. And it was Sergio Ramos scored the equaliser. And my wife and my son still remind me to this day of my reaction in that wee bar in Spain. I went mental because all those years of pent-up frustration and the thought that they were going to become European champions, it goes to show how even after all those years, there is a psychological scar that's still there. Atletico will always be hated in my eyes.
Well, it's the same way that... you know, a wee bit younger, marginally younger than you, I hate Rapid Vienna.
Correct.
I mean, I'm just annoyed that we didn't beat Rapid Vienna 500-0 when we played them recently in European competition, because that would have been one goal not enough.
I think what we didn't realise, Atletico Madrid, and was that it was the end of an era. It was the end of a golden era.
Yeah.
It wasn't Europe, and... you know, the glamour of playing AC Milan and Inter Milan and the great teams was about to be replaced by getting knocked out by teams like Wisla Krakow and Sachsen-Brichau and, you know, Olympiakos. And I kind of had a look at the stats, and in the next 28 seasons, we would only have two significant away victories against quality opposition, both against Ajax. And so our European form just collapsed.
Utterly collapsed. I mean, utterly collapsed after that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I looked at Olympiakos, Sachsenring, Zwickau, Wisla Krakow and Innsbruck. And in none of we went out of Europe to all four of these teams, and in none of the away games did we even score a goal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a significant decline, and you know, people like Kenny Dalglish still playing. And I guess when we go on to next week's programme, we'll be talking about the different elements of that decline.
Yeah. So after the downer of Atletico, we're going to finish this week on a high. We win the double. We secure the double with a 3-0 victory against Dundee United. The teams that day, getting back to what we talked about with the goalkeepers, Dennis Cunningham was in goals, Danny McGrain, Brogan, Murray, McNeil, McCluskey, Johnson, Hood, Deans, Hay, Dalglish, Lennox and Callaghan with the subs. Dundee United team, Davey, Gardner, Coppell, Copeland, Smith, Payne, Knox, Gray, Fleming, Houston. Some interesting players on that park. So, were you back for your honeymoon, Lackey? Yeah. Did you get to the game?
I did, aye. Yeah.
And how was it?
What he was playing for the Dundee United on that day. I watched it again the other day on YouTube, and there was one challenge on the Celtic goalkeeper from Walter Smith. It was rather robust. So, I thought, you know, he hadn't changed then when he became a manager. But Celtic were a much better team than them on the day. I think that was the first time they'd ever played in a cup final.
Mm-hmm.
But, yes. I mean, you've got players like Harry Hood and Dixie Deans and Callaghan and Ole, Dalglish and Stevie Murray. They were better players, so they were always going to win. It was a comfortable victory.
It was, and I think this was the early days of Jim McLean as a manager. And
Andy Gray was playing.
Andy Gray had a fabulous diving header, which Dennis Connachan clawed it away early in the second half when it was 2-0 at the time. And if they'd got back into the game, I mean, Andy Gray, I think, was only 18. It was a fantastic save by Big Dennis. And, you know, so they had, you know, the Graham Payne. I think David Neary did not play in the final. It was maybe a bit too early for him. But, you know, this was the start of what was going to be an unbelievable 20 years for Dundee United in terms of Europe and titles and cups and cup finals. And, yeah, I mean, Walter Smith and Archie Knox both playing for Dundee United that day, so it was a comfortable event, very comfortable one. I remember going in the boys' gate, and I put on my big, thick football socks under my jeans, and I had two cans of Tennent's down each leg, and there was about six or seven of us from school went to the Rangers' end, which was maybe ill-advised, but, you know, we enjoyed our beers on the... it was quite a big crowd, but it wasn't that packed. You know, it wasn't nothing like the Hibs or Aberdeen Cup finals. 75,000. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It felt comfortable and almost spacious, but I enjoyed that Cup final.
Hearts had actually been big favourites to win the semi. It was quite a shock, actually, but when United beat them in a replay, because... Hearts had finished higher up the league, and I think that there was disappointment at Tynecastle when they didn't get to the final. But from memory, I think Jim McLean's mistake before the game was he made a comment along the lines of that Celtic now only had two class players in their team, which were Danny McGrain and Kenny Dalglish. Now, in fairness, there was a wee element of truth in that. However, we still had some fantastic players who had a good bit of football in them. And Harry Hood had a fantastic game that day. He scored the first goal, he set up the second goal, and just his all-round game, he was absolutely tremendous. And Hood was man of the match. And Dennis Conaghan, much maligned Dennis Conaghan, had a terrific game, made the save for Andy Gray, and that's one of the games that Celtic fans remember most about Dennis Conaghan. I did a podcast with him a couple of years ago, and he's especially proud of his performance in that game. And I heard TalkSport a couple of years ago when Andy Gray was reminiscing in his career, and he says, that big bandit Conaghan, he says, I was sure that was going in. He says, that would have been, it would have changed the whole shape of the game if United could have got an equaliser, and made it more of a game for the neutral, actually. But Celtic, after going 2-0 up fairly early in the game, were comfortable winners that day and probably should have scored some more.
As you said earlier, St Anthony, Jinky had ended the season on a real high. He must have missed 20, 25 games that season, but the last dozen games he played so well that he actually got himself back into the Scotland team and got himself on the plane to West Germany.
He
had a man of the match performance against England at Hampden, where he was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
So wee Jimmy came good at the right time, and I think we'd lost so many cup finals in the last few years that it was, you know, we really started to appreciate winning cup finals again. You know, that was the number that thrown away.
The save that Conaghan made was at 2-0, so he was just if he thought it was an equaliser. They did have a flurry after half time and had a couple of chances, but overall it was a very comfortable win for Celtic.
That was my first cup final, and I remember my dad got his tickets for the stand, and I remember the excitement. You know, just it's great to have memories like that you can look back on, and I can remember the whole day. You know, it was a wonderful memory. So it was, and it also became very exciting to be a football fan at that period with Scotland's imminent place in the World Cup finals in West Germany. That was a very exciting period.
I was just going to say, it gets back to a point I touched on about 4 or 5 podcasts ago, that ironically, we, Scottish football, 4+ years ago, from recording, you know, in terms of the seasons of this, the teams were achieving in European football. Now we were moving to a period, as you just touched on, Robert, where the teams weren't, we've got Aberdeen and Dundee United in another 10 years' time, but we've got a period in the next 6-7 years when the Scottish club teams are not achieving anything in European football, yet we're about to see really exciting stuff of the 74 World Cup going home without losing a game and going to the 78 World Cup with a genuine belief that Scotland could get to the semi-finals. With the quality of players that they had available, it's an amazing difference. So we secure the double, and then the excitement is for the 74 World Cup. There's any other sort of key memories you have, Saint, of this season and the excitement of the 74 World Cup?
Well, one thing we've not mentioned so far is for a few games, Celtic began to wear a new strip when it was a clash of colours. It was green and white. Green and black vertical stripes, black shorts and black socks, almost like Inter Milan, but with green rather than blue. Yeah. And I remember at the time, for recollection is, the fans found it very favourable, and it was very popular. And yet, I think we only played 2 or 3 games in it, and we never played in it again. And we sort of adopted it in later years. I think it was under the Nike regime.
Yeah.
We went back to something similar. And it is a very smart strip for us to have it as a change strip. And I often wonder why we never persevered with that, because it was very popular.
Well, because they meant a green in it, probably, so that if we're changing it to because of the green and white hoops, then we're not doing it. But for a bit, you know, talked earlier about Sabutio, always remember, if you went on the Sabutio catalogue to buy your team, the Celtic second strip in the Sabutio catalogue well after we were not wearing that strip was the green and black striped strip, because I never saw Celtic wearing the green and white, the green and black striped strip. Yet you would look at the Sabutio catalogue and it'd be like, why is that as our away strip? Because we've never worn it in my since I've been going to see games.
We played a game. We played a game against Ayr United around about March, and I remember it for two things. Jimmy Johnson scored two penalties. He never took penalties very often. And the other thing I remember as well is Alec Ferguson was playing for Ayr United, and I couldn't believe, even as a boy, the abuse that that man took that day because he was an ex-Rangers player. It was my first experience of Celtic fans responding to an ex-Rangers player, and he took, honest to God, he took absolute dog's abuse that day. You couldn't believe it.
The thing I remember about that Ayr United game, apart from Jimmy's two penalties, is because he had a skinhead. It was absolutely right into the wood, shocking looking skinhead. Did we not wear the green and black stripes when we won the league sometime in the last 10 years or so at Rugby Park? Was Nakamura not wearing it at the time of the free kick?
Yeah, we did.
You're right.
So, Lackey, any specific memories of that season or the excitement of the 74 World Cup?
There were two. One is that on that day when Celtic won the Scottish Cup, Bill Shankly resigned as manager of Liverpool. They beat Newcastle in the FA Cup final, and he resigned the manager's job at Liverpool. So that was an epoch-changing day for another great club.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, too, that Jinky had played brilliantly against, was it Northern Ireland?
Wales.
In the midweek.
And then Wales came in midweek.
He went for a wee cruise down by Largs.
Yeah.
In his boat. And then they brought him back for the England game, and he terrorised England. And I always thought, I believe it to this day, do you remember when they went to the World Cup and they played Zaire?
Mm-hmm.
And they went two up. And he kept Jimmy Johnston on the bench. And I kept thinking, if you bring him on, he will tear this team apart. And they ended up going out because they never scored enough goals. And Jimmy Johnston never played. And I thought that was a disgrace. I thought that was a wee blight on Ormond's great record as Scotland manager, that I don't know why he didn't play Jimmy Johnston in the actual World Cup ties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Yugoslavians were terrified of him after what happened. Red Star Belgrade, and they couldn't believe that Jimmy Johnston didn't get on that day.
It was the same left back. The guy who was left back for Yugoslavia in the 74 World Cup was the same left back that Jimmy had ripped to shreds.
Even on the basis of the home internationals, he was a standout. He played brilliantly. And that's why he went with them to Germany. And not to play him was just...
Lucky mentioned Zaire there. I remember having an atlas as a boy, and my dad made me get the atlas out because none of us knew. We knew they were African, certainly, but my dad had never, he'd never heard of Zaire. It was actually a fairly new country, and it had been Belgian Congo in his day. And it was only when we get the atlas out and we saw where it was, the geography of the place, and the former, the colonial name, if you like, of Belgian Congo, that it became obvious to my dad which country we were actually playing, because up to that point, he didn't have a clue.
Well, a few months later, everybody knew about them when Muhammad
Rumble
Ali
in the Jungle.
George Foreman there, so it was the same year. The other, just going back to Scottish clubs in Europe, Harry, I think maybe the outstanding performance the Scottish club in Europe that season was Hibs against Leeds United in the Intercity Spurs Cup. And both games finished 0-0, and Leeds won a penalty shootout, and Leeds won the title that year, the First Division Championship, by a distance. They were the best team in England that year. And the other thing I remember, and I thought Lackey was maybe going to mention it there, was Man United getting relegated.
Mm-hmm.
And Dennis Law scoring for Man City with a back heel, mm-hmm. and then not celebrating. I think it was the first time I'd ever seen a player not celebrating after scoring. And, you know, so that had, you know, one wonders what was going through Lou McCarrie's mind at that time. You know, because not only had he just been relegated with Man U, but he didn't make the World Cup squad for West.
And yet there were three Man U players in the squad. Now, you would think a team that get relegated didn't have a good season. And the Scottish centre defence was the Man United duo of Martin Buchan and Jim Holton, with Willie Morgan in midfield. And you know, that I don't know how... At the time, it didn't seem that strange, but I think it would be very strange these days if a team get relegated in any league and the two centre-halves at international level.
There was, of course, a lot of rumour, and it's been written about that certainly Martin Buchan complained because he had been left out of the first match, and John Blackley had played alongside Holton in the Zaire game. And, you know, I think he was bending Willie Orman's ear, and maybe Willie Morgan too. And I think Jimmy Johnson, as Lackey says, Jimmy Johnson should certainly have played in the Zaire game and probably in the Yugoslavia game. Maybe not against Brazil, which was going to be a different type of game. But, you know, there were certainly suggestions that Orman was a bit weak with his selections. But, you know, at the end of the day, and to be fair to Ormond, we were unbeaten. And it was an opportunity lost for Scotland.
And it was during this time, in the next sort of, through the 74, 78, 82 World Cup in particular, that and certainly 78, that the accusations started to be thrown about that the Anglo players were more likely to get picked than the Scottish-based players.
Even
if the Scottish-based players was perceived to be better, there was a perception that because they were playing in England, things were better, so they must be a better player. One of the other things for me about all of this is, getting back to something I touched on earlier, in the depths of this, you've got the state of emergency. I mean, the UK going into a state of emergency, and then a three-day week, you know, and television and lights off at 10:30 at night, and football having to be played during the day because there's not enough power to put on the lights. It just shows you, you know, for the current lockdown that we're in, even in the middle of, you know, things get better, things improve. Mm-hmm. We'll be playing indeed football in front of games again. It must have felt really bleak. It must have been a great time to be organising your wedding, Lackey, in the bleakest of all of that. How is wedding planning going on with the prospect of a 3-day week and all of that?
Well, I don't know. We were in a 3-day week. We were teachers.
Yeah, but the world itself would have been a dark place.
Oh, I remember that the worst thing was the sewage. The you know, they weren't picking up the rubbish, and there was mountains of black plastic bags in the street and plagues of rats and stuff like that. It was pretty grim. It really was in that winter.
Anyway,
I actually remember it's quite an exciting period, in as much as a child you can be quite resilient because you just, you know, you're living in your own wee bubble, if you like. And we used to come back from school and get our dinner, and then basically the TV would go off around about 8 o'clock, and all the lights would go off, and my mother would get the candles out for church that she'd purchased and light them, and that's where I learned to play cards. Because the three of us would just sit there, it was too early to go to bed, and we wouldn't have any heat, so you'd be sitting with big jumpers and, you know, like two pairs of socks on because there wasn't any heating, and you would be have these couple of candles, and you would basically just try and amuse yourself, you would just try and play cards, and then go to bed about 10 o'clock. But it seems, looking back, worse than maybe what it was at the time, which I wonder if... We will look back in this now, although this is lasting a lot longer than I think people had hoped for.
I think, though, that, as we touched on it last week, if you watch films of the 70s in Glasgow, particularly Glasgow, it was a dull, dark...
It was grim.
It really was pretty grim. Mm-hmm. You know, when they were in the business of knocking down the tenements and building the new estates and things, but it wasn't a nice place.
No. No, I think, I mean, it was a wee bit later on, but there was a photographic exhibition about a year ago, and it was so a wee bit later, but the same period of the Sunday Times had sent one of the photographers in 1979 up to Glasgow to photograph the city. To the, they were then going to do a piece in the Sunday Times magazine about, you know, what used to be set, the Empire setting city. And the pictures that the guy came back with were so bleak and grim that, uh-huh, that they didn't run with them.
Yeah.
And it was only last year when the guy did an exhibition, and it was pictures on a Saturday afternoon of, like, Argyle Street and Buchanan Street, of people lying in the street, steaming,
drunk
out of their face, and the buildings were black, and kids were black, and, oh, the pictures are... So you forget what a bleak, grey, black place Glasgow was at the time.
Those photos...
You watched last night, there was a programme, first of this new series of Billy Connolly's series on BBC Scotland. And, you know, he was going on about childhood and stuff. I mean, you see the state of the place. It was minging. I mean, I remember growing up in that, you know, back courts, doing the jumps and all that stuff, you know, up the back of Mill Road Street. And the Carlton was a pretty grim place to live, I can assure you. Don't know why we kept going back there.
The photos that you're talking about, Brian, some of them were taken in Govan, in a place called Howitt Street.
Yeah.
And at that time, I was two streets away from that. And I recognised some of the people, and it was wee kids that he was taking
That's
photos
right,
of.
Yeah.
It wasn't the adults. And I recognised some of the kids that were younger than me at the time. But the friends that I have, and we were discussing those photographs, looking back on it in later years, we didn't appreciate how bad it was at the time. It's only in later years with what you've got now.
Yeah.
That, I mean, we've all got double glazing now. We've all got central heating. Certainly, hopefully, everybody has that now. And probably these days, well, front gardens and back gardens. You didn't have that then. Everybody stayed up a close. And it could be quite a... although it looks quite a rough existence, it was home to us. And it was only in later years that you think back how grim it must have been.
Well, that's the thing. I think that's your experience. So you didn't know any, you know, better getting back mm-hmm. to, you know...
The only thing, before we close, the Ron Yeats testimonial was an interesting end to the season.
Mm.
When Bobby Charlton played for Celtic.
He did?
Yep.
He scored for Celtic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That was when he famously said that he'd wished he'd had Bobby Lennox playing with him throughout his career. He thought he was a brilliant player. I thought that was spoke volumes for Bobby Lennox when Bobby mm-hmm. Charlton said he was a brilliant player. I think Bobby was probably the most underrated Celtic player in my lifetime.
It's quite interesting you should say that, because Bobby brought a book out, and he's such a mild-mannered guy. I've met Bobby Lennox, I've spoken to him. He is a lovely man, genuinely lovely man. And the cup final in 74 against Dundee United, and the cup final in 70, in fact, there was three cup finals in a row, 72, 73, 74. Bobby was on the bench, and he, at least two of them he should have played. And he says, when it came to picking the team, Jock took the easy option because he knew Bobby wouldn't complain, because Bobby was just, he wasn't that kind of guy.
Yeah.
He was just happy to be there. He was happy with his lot. And he says, I think Jock took the easy option, in as much as he left me out, whereas if he'd left somebody else out, he was in for a fight. And he says he knew I wouldn't give him a fight.
Interesting. Is it not the case that Bobby Lennox is still the most decorated player
Aye.
In our history?
Mm-hmm.
He's probably the most decorated player in Scottish football history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How many titles did he win?
I think, well, right.
Technically it's 11.
11?
Yeah, but that was the season that he broke his leg against Rangers, so the argument is that he didn't play enough games. But he played in 11 title-winning seasons.
I think he did.
He got 25 major honours, which is just ahead of Big Billy. And Scott Brown will be getting closer to that next week,
be.
I suppose.
Hopefully. Listen, see, just before we go, I've got one wee song for you. I know that we touched on the songs last week, and you'll be happy to know it's not as crude as last week's. So, again, it's more of a school song than probably was sung at the games, but I'm interested to hear Robert's reaction if it was. And the Carpenters were at number one with I'm on top of the world. I can all remember the song.
Yeah.
And the song went, we're on the top of the world looking down on the Rangers, and the only explanation we can find is the team that we've got is the best team of the lot, and they've put us on the top of the league.
Yeah.
So the Carpenters can eat their heart out.
Well, with that song,
when we were, remember Nobody's Child?
Yes.
Alexander Brothers.
Yes, I remember. So when I was slowly passing by Ibrox Park one day, I stopped there for a moment to watch the Rangers play. Alone, the boss was standing, and when I asked him why, he turned with eyes that filled with tears, and he began to cry. I've no got a side. I've no got a side. Just like the thistle. We're on the slide. No Bob Murdoch and no Yogi Bear. No Jimmy Johnson. It just isn't fair.
Superb.
Right, with that, I will say, because that's 2 hours, that's the end of the 9 in a row. But next season, we will be back to see why we didn't do 10. So with that, I'll say thanks very much, boys.
Thank you.
Enjoyed the podcast. We've certainly enjoyed pulling this series together for you. As I say, there's one more episode left, which we'll be talking about why the 10 didn't happen. You're listening to ABBA Waterloo, the start of an incredible pop career there. And I don't know if you saw during the week in Peter Lawwell's letter to the fans following the successful 9 in a row, Celtic FC Foundation have now raised and spent assisting in this current pandemic, £450,000. It's an incredible feat by the foundation, incredible feat by the supporters. So anyway, we're going to be through this soon enough. We will be back at Celtic Park soon enough. I'm going to go and be, I'm feeling really optimistic today, so I'm going for, I'll be in my seat in November, God willing. Anyway, that's my overly optimistic note to finish on. It's me, Harry Brady. That was Robert Lucky Morrison Anthony. That's the 9 in a row Chronicles. That was season 9. Saying good night and God bless. Good night.